Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 6, Chapter 7. And it goes a little bit like this. Nearly 2 years before this, in 1808, Pierre, on returning to Petersburg after visiting his estates, had involuntarily found himself in a leading position among the Petersburg Freemasons. He arranged dining and funeral lodge meetings, enrolled new members, and busied himself uniting various lodges and acquiring authentic charters. He gave money for the erection of temples, and supplemented, as far as he could, the collection of alms, in regard to which the majority of members were stingy and irregular. He supported, almost single-handedly, a poorhouse the order had founded in Petersburg. His life, meanwhile, continued as before, with the same infatuations and dissipations. He liked to dine and drink well, and though he considered it immoral and humiliating, could not resist the temptations of the bachelor circles in which he moved. Amid the turmoil of his activities and distractions, however, Pierre, at the end of a year, began to feel that the more firmly he tried to rest upon it, the more the Masonic ground on which he stood gave way under him. At the same time, he felt that the deeper the ground sank under him, the closer bound he involuntarily became to the order. When he had joined the Freemasons, he had experienced the feeling of one who confidently steps onto the smooth surface of a bog. When he put his foot down, it sank in. To make quite sure of the firmness of the ground, he put his other foot down and sank deeper still, became stuck in it, and involuntarily waded knee-deep in the bog. Joseph Alexeyevich was not in Petersburg. He had of late stood aside from the affairs of the Petersburg lodges and lived almost entirely in Moscow. All the members of the lodge were men Pierre knew in ordinary life, and it was difficult for him to regard them merely as brothers in Freemasonry and not as Prince B or Ivan Vasilievich D, whom he knew in society mostly as weak and insignificant men. Under the Masonic aprons and insignia, he saw the uniforms and decorations at which they aimed in ordinary life. Often after collecting alms and reckoning up 20 to 30 rubles received, for the most part in promises from a dozen members, of whom half were as well able to pay as himself, Pierre remembered the Masonic vow in which each brother promised to devote all his belongings to his neighbour, and doubts on which he tried not to dwell arose in his soul. He divided the brothers he knew into four categories. In the first he put those who did not take an active part in the affairs of the lodges or in human affairs, but were exclusively occupied with the mystical science of the order, with questions of the threefold designation of God, the three primordial elements, sulphur, mercury, and salt, or the meaning of the square and all the various figures of the Temple of Solomon. Pierre respected this class of brothers, to which the elder ones chiefly belonged, including Pierre thought Joseph Alexeyevich himself, but he did not share their interests. His heart was not in the mystical aspect of Freemasonry. In the second category, Pierre reckoned himself and others like him, seeking and vacillating, who had not yet found in Freemasonry a straight and comprehensible path, but hoped to do so. In the third category he included those brothers, the majority, who saw nothing in Freemasonry but the external forms and ceremonies, and prized the strict performance of these forms without troubling about their purport or significance. Such were Wilarski, and even the Grand Master of the principal lodge. Finally, to the fourth category also a great many brothers belonged, particularly those who had lately joined. These, according to Pierre's observation, were men who had no belief in anything, nor desire for anything, but joined the Freemasons merely to associate with the wealthy young brothers who were influential through their connections or rank, and of whom there were very many in the lodge. Pierre began to feel dissatisfied with what he was doing. Freemasonry, at any rate, as he saw it here, sometimes seemed to him based merely on externals. He did not think of doubting Freemasonry itself, but suspected that Russian Masonry had taken a wrong path and deviated from its original principles, and so, towards the end of the year, he went abroad to be initiated into the higher secrets of the order. In the summer of 1809, Pierre returned to Petersburg. Our Freemasons knew from correspondence with those abroad that Bezukhov had obtained the confidence of many highly placed persons, had been initiated into many mysteries, had been raised to a higher grade, and was bringing back with him much that might conduce to the advantage of the Masonic cause in Russia. The Petersburg Freemasons all came to see him, tried to ingratiate themselves with him, and it seemed to them all that he was preparing something for them and concealing it. A solemn meeting of the Lodge of the Second Degree was convened, at which Pierre promised to communicate to the Petersburg brothers what he had to deliver to them from the highest leaders of their order. The meeting was a full one. After the usual ceremonies, Pierre rose and began his address. "Dear brothers," he began, blushing and stammering, with a written speech in his hand, "it is not sufficient to observe our mysteries in the seclusion of our lodge. We must act. Act. We are drowsing, but we must act." Pierre raised his notebook and began to read. "For the dissemination of pure truth and to secure the triumph of virtue," he read, "we must clean men from prejudice, diffuse principles in harmony with the spirit of the times, undertake the education of the young, unite ourselves in indissoluble bonds with the wisest men, boldly yet prudently overcome superstitions, infidelity, and folly, and form of those devoted to us a body linked together by unity of purpose and possessed of authority and power. To attain this end, we must secure a preordinance of virtue over vice, and must endeavour to secure that the honest man may, even in this world, receive a lasting reward for his virtue. But in these great endeavours we are gravely hampered by the political institutions of today. What is to be done in these circumstances to favour revolutions, overthrow everything, repel force by force? No, we are very far from that. Every violent reform deserves censure, for it quite fails to remedy evil while men remain what they are, and also because wisdom needs no violence. The whole plan of our order should be based on the idea of preparing men of firmness and virtue bound together by unity of conviction, aiming at the punishment of vice and folly and patronizing talent and virtue, raising worthy men from the dust and attaching them to our brotherhood. Only then will our order have the power, unobtrusively, to bind the hands of the protectors of disorder and to control them without their being aware of it. In a word, we must found a form of government holding universal sway, which should be diffused over the whole world without destroying the bonds of citizenship, and besides which all our governments can continue in their customary course and do everything except what impedes the great aim of our order, which is to obtain for virtue the victory over vice. This aim was that of Christianity itself. It taught men to be wise and good, and for their own benefit to follow the example and instruction of the best and wisest men. At that time, when everything was plunged in darkness, preaching alone was of course sufficient. The novelty of truth endowed her with special strength, but now we need much more powerful methods. It is now necessary that man, governed by his sense, should find in virtue a charm palpable to those senses. It is impossible to eradicate the passions, but we must strive to direct them to a noble aim, and it is therefore necessary that everyone should be able to satisfy his passions within the limits of virtue. Our order should provide means to that end. As soon as we have a certain number of worthy men in every state, each of them again training two others and all being closely united, everything will be possible for our order, which has already in secret accomplished much for the welfare of mankind. This speech not only made a strong impression, but created excitement in the lodge. The majority of the brothers, seeing in it dangerous designs of Illuminism, met it with a coldness that surprised Pierre. The Grand Master began answering him, and Pierre began developing his views with more and more warmth. It was long since there had been so stormy a meeting. Parties were formed, some accusing Pierre of Illuminism, others supporting him. At that meeting he was struck for the first time by the endless variety of men's minds, which prevents a truth from ever presenting itself identically to two persons. Even those members who seemed to be on his side understood him in their own way. With limitations and alterations he could not agree to, as what he always wanted, most was to convey this thought to others just as he himself understood it. At the end of the meeting, the Grand Master reproved Bezukhov with irony and ill will for his vehemence, and said it was not love of virtue alone, but also a love of strife that had moved him in the dispute. Pierre did not answer him, and asked briefly whether his proposal would be accepted. He was told that it would not, and without waiting for the usual formalities, he left the lodge and went home. All right, there we have it, another chapter down. Pierre seems to have disgraced himself in the eyes of his Freemason brothers with what can only be described as a long and boring speech. I think all the listeners know how I feel about these speeches where they talk about philosophy and religion, that kind of thing. They make me go a bit glassy-eyed. I apologize if that read became a little bit monotonous towards the end there. So here's a comment from someone who I don't think we've had on the podcast before, Too Clever by 87/15. They said, "I found it amusing, given modern conspiracy theories, that Tolstoy's Freemasons reject Pierre's proposal for sounding too much like the Illuminati." Welcome to the podcast, Too Clever by 87/15, and I also found that pretty amusing. I wasn't sure if that's what they were talking about when they said Illuminous or whatever the word was, but yeah, I think they were saying he sounds Illuminati-ish-esque. So, Pierre, in typical Pierre fashion, has just followed his whim, the same whim that got him his huge inheritance and made all the changes in his life, made him win that duel, made him get married in the first place, and also at this point it seems to have made him a leader in the Freemasons in Russia. But he's still suffering that same problem, isn't he? He's got these ideals, but he doesn't act them out. He's got these ideas about reforms that he wants to see, and he's even pitched them to his Freemason friends here, but when they reject him, he just sort of takes it and goes, "Oh, okay, I suppose I'll go home." It was a long chapter, and there seems to be a lot to unpack in that speech, but it might be a case of revisiting it in the next episode, so I can do some research in the in-between time and know what the heck I'm talking about. So on that note, that's going to do us for today. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.